This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Corporations are facing increasingly less regulation and taxes and seeing enormous profits, and people are struggling.
The gentleman who owns 4 muffler shops, right? He has 102 employees. So the question is he a millionaire? Is he a billionaire? I would argue not.
And he talks about working people, but you can't have working people without jobs.
$30 a month is not going to change their bottom line.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Later, a breakdown of the day's top local news stories. But first, for pretty much its entire 52-year lifespan, Chicago's employer head tax has been labeled a job killer. And now that Mayor Brandon Johnson wants to bring back a revamped version, about $33 a month for employees at companies with 500 or more workers, the pushback from some city council members and business leaders is loud and clear. They say companies will flee, jobs will vanish. You know the script. Now, that back and forth leads us to this week, when the City Council will hold a series of meetings to be able to vote on the budget before Christmas. I want you to check your calendar, folks, because that means they only have 10 days to figure this out. And back to that debate on whether or not the head tax is a job killer, well, the numbers don't exactly back that up. A new WBEZ analysis finds there's little evidence the old corporate head tax actually hurt job growth. So, as the stakes here continue to climb, we are crunching the data on the impacts of a corporate head tax with a panel of experts. At the table, Robert Bruno, director of the Labor Education Program at the School for Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ's City Government and Politics reporter, and Amy Chin, who's WBEZ's data reporter. So the corporate head tax, as I mentioned, Mariah, it's been called a job killer kind of forever, at least since it was passed in the 70s. Why? Where did that messaging come from?
Sure. So, yeah, it's been called a job killer by a large swath of people, including businesses, aldermen, and even mayors since its inception in 1973. I was going back through some city council debates from that time. And when the city council passed the corporate head tax, which originally charged companies with 15 or more employees $3 per person, so much different than the proposal we're looking at now. Mm-hmm. There was a long debate. It was an hour-long debate between alder people who opposed and supported this tax. It ended up passing 35-8. But ahead of that city council meeting, similar to the ones today, businesses in Chicago packed the public comment section and said, this will be bad for business. I can't afford to pay this. Of course, that was a much smaller portion of companies that were affected.
And were they drawing from any particular evidence back then that this was going to do that?
I think that they were just drawing from the, you know, common sense idea that if I have to pay more, then, you know, that's going to affect who I can hire. And we can kind of get into what the research actually shows around that. Yeah. But at that time, I believe that they were drawing simply from the fact that their costs were going up. Mm-hmm. And so that was going to affect what they could put
out. Why would we want to add an additional $3 a month for our employees at the time? So, Professor Bruno, I mean, what are critics, you think, drawing from today? What evidence, why are they so worked up, the business leaders?
Yeah. Well, I don't think they're drawing from much more than what they drew from back in 1973, 1974. There really isn't, from my reading of the research, and let me say that the folks on the panel here did a really wonderful job, both Amy and Mariah, in putting together that analysis. Mm-hmm. And frankly, when you look more broadly at the kind of analysis that's been done on payroll taxes, on taxes overall, and specifically where possible on a payroll head tax, you simply don't arrive at any conclusion that there's been any dramatic impact on business establishments or employment. So I think it's coming simply from a typical historical business narrative that they're anti-regulation and they want to, of course, reduce any kind of additional expense on their end.
And we should say that we did find in our analysis that these types of taxes, similar to a head tax, can have an impact on jobs because on smaller, newer firms. When you get into larger firms like 500 plus companies, the researcher who did that, did some of that leading research, says that the impacts start to become much less the larger the company gets.
So it's not a matter of a yes or no, and this analysis, this data says, you know, completely it's not a job killer or it is a job killer. It's a little bit more complicated than that. And even though the data analysis that you all came up with shows little connection between the job trends between, you know, 1974 and now, we can't say whether that would be the case for what Johnson is now proposing. You're nodding, Amy.
Yeah, exactly. We looked at historically how jobs have trended since, you know, the imposition of the tax, the repeal, the revisions, and it's inconclusive, really, from the data. And, you know, the saying goes, correlation does not equal causation. And so you do see a correlation in kind of jobs taking a little bit of a decline when it was implemented, and then jobs going back up when it was repealed. Yeah. But you don't necessarily, you can't ascribe a specific cause to that.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that. But the narrative, as we mentioned here, is that this is going to be, this equals danger for large companies, especially. I spoke last week with two aldermen who are part of a group of them who are proposing an alternative budget. And I want to play a little bit from Alderman Timmy Knudsen of the 43rd Ward. Here he is sharing his concern about new startups.
Chicago is really strategically placed to be a hub in the country for startups and founders, better cost of living than the coast, a lot of Big Ten talent. So specifically for that, any tax that we put on jobs, it argues against more jobs. When you tax something, it limits the result.
So Mariah, you spoke with Audrey Guo, who's an economics professor at the Santa Clara University's Levy School of Business. What did she say when it comes to the effect of payroll taxes on newer employees?
Yeah, so her research shows that these types of taxes can be burdensome for smaller, younger firms, and in some cases can lead to a 2.2% in year-over-year employment growth for those types of firms, much smaller than 500-plus. She also says, her research also shows that these taxes can affect lower-paid positions at larger companies, because if a company is thinking about how to, you know, make ends meet or increase their profits, they're going to look at what percentage of my labor costs are growing at the highest rate. And so for taxing, you know, a person who makes $77,000 a year, for instance, a $200 yearly or monthly payment on that person's salary is going to be a much larger burden and share than it is of a salary that's $200,000. That person might be more specialized, harder to get rid of. And so she does see this effect on lower wage workers who either companies can lessen pay overall across the board to make up for the head tax or get rid of some of those lower income jobs.
Yeah. And I want to dig more into the data with you, Amy, because as we said, the head tax was implemented back in the 70s. We did see a job decline in the late 70s into the 80s. You put together a really neat line graph outlining all of this in that article that's online at WBEZ.org. Tell me more about what the data tells you. What's the story that you see there?
Yeah, I wish I could like show people my hands and which direction they're going. But yeah, you know,
they just got to go to WBEZ.org.
they do. Yeah, we see a dip in the number of jobs. And so first of all, we compared the city of Chicago versus suburban Cook County, because at the time, suburban Cook County didn't have a head tax. So it's kind of a good, you know, comparison point to look at. And we do see an initial dip in the 70s, early 70s, when the head tax was implemented. And then we see that dip kind of continue for the city of Chicago, while suburban Cook County kind of sees the exact opposite. They see an increase in jobs throughout the 70s and 80s. And then when the head tax is revised from applying to just 15 or more employees per company to 50, you see these two lines between the city of Chicago and Cook County kind of mirroring each other. Mm. It stays relatively flat for a bit, and then you see that kind of dip again in 2008 following the housing market crash. And then after that, the city of Chicago's job growth actually outpaces Cook County. And so, you know, looking at the data, it's kind of hard to say, you know, what the reasons exactly are, and I'll leave it to the experts. But
right. I'm looking at you now, Professor Bruno. I mean, talk more about the economic factors that you think we should be considering during that time that would have led to job loss.
Sure. Well, the most obvious is that Chicago suffered a dramatic loss of manufacturing jobs starting in the late 70s throughout the 80s, even into the 1990s, we're talking a good 200,000 and upwards of manufacturing jobs. And manufacturing jobs have a real multiplier effect on the economy. And so when those jobs disappear, it's a real drag on the economy. And obviously Chicago's economy was built to a large extent around manufacturing, or certainly it was a much larger share of the workforce and industries than it would have been the case in its surrounding suburbs. So when manufacturing took a big hit, then Chicago saw its economy alter and switch to a predominant service economy over that time. So it doesn't surprise me that the suburban communities who weren't as dependent on manufacturing could have sustained better job growth. And I think you just have to factor in all of these other impacts, these other variables. It's very complicated, and as Amy said, to try to actually draw causation to one variable.
And Mariah, we're focused a lot on the 70s and in just what that old version looked like. But I mean, there was a corporate head tax that eventually got repealed under Rahm Emanuel in 2014. Any big differences there between that version and what Mayor Johnson's proposing now? Or at least this latest version, because it's changed over the last several weeks.
Right. I would say some pretty significant differences. One is the price. It's $33 compared to what ended up being a $4 head tax when it was repealed.
And even with the passage of time and inflation, Johnson's version is still more expensive.
Yeah, I think, you know, when they have initially proposed this as a $21 per person head tax, they said that that would have been what the head tax would have been if it kept up with inflation.
More comparable.
The other major difference is that this would affect companies of 500 plus employees as opposed to companies with 50 plus employees, which our analysis showed if you taxed the companies that were part of the former head tax at that rate, it would have affected just 1% of all businesses. You know, only 1% of the businesses that were taxed before were 500 plus companies.
I see.
And of course, Chicago's business landscape has changed since 2014. You can't apply that apples to apples, but it gives us some idea since Johnson's administration hasn't released the names of the companies they think that would be affected by their current proposal.
So, Professor Bruno, you know, we talk about this 1% here of companies in Chicago who would actually pay this head tax, at least according to Mayor Johnson. I mean, your thoughts of that, does that change things?
Well, what it focuses on is that it's going to impact a really small number of employers, large employers, employers whose employees probably have an average income. I think I saw in the analysis that Amy and Mariah did, over $111,000.
And the whole reason he says he's doing this is to keep this extra money off of low-income people.
Well, so you have to consider the alternative, right? If not this revenue source, what other revenue source?
Right.
And this revenue source is essentially taxing the employer, large, very prominent employers who will, I would suggest, will suffer no negative consequences as alternative to other kinds of regressive taxes that are going to be felt by working and middle-class folks. So it's a small group of employers, but the revenue would be substantial. And that revenue then can be used in lots of different ways as it had been used by previous mayors to positive effect as opposed to a tax on working class folks in Chicago.
You give us an even clearer picture in your data, Amy, on, you know, just how large the companies were that did pay the head tax. back in the past. You also break down the business industries here in Illinois by size, just to sort of give us a better picture of exactly who's going to be paying this. What else should we learn from that?
Yeah. And we did this because we wanted a sense of, you know, who are these 500 plus employee companies? You know, are they really the largest kind of multinational companies? Are they restaurants?
So healthcare and social assistance?
Yeah. Healthcare, social assistance, I think tech and consulting, mm-hmm. manufacturing, those were among kind of the most prominent industries that we saw among Illinois businesses with 500 or more employees. And as Professor Bruno did mention, we ran the numbers on kind of what the average salary of those businesses are, and mm-hmm. it's the bigger that you get, the higher the average salary is. And so if for businesses with like 50 or less employees, it's around 68,000. And then as you get to like businesses with 500 or more, it's 111,000. And so we looked at kind of the business industry breakdown, the salary breakdown, but we also looked at the city's own data that they collected from 2000 to 2013.
Right.
And it is anonymized data, so we can't see company names, but it is kind of the only way we're able to see essentially how many businesses are of what size in Chicago. And so, yeah, that's kind of how we got the 1%.
So, Mariah, what questions remain for you here, you know, about which companies this will apply to and what the future, where the future lies here with this tax? Folks are meeting, what, this morning and throughout the rest of the week?
Yeah, and I mean, so many questions remain. This analysis was a narrow examination of, does this one claim that is being used in this argument hold up against the evidence? And we didn't find necessarily that it doesn't. We just found that there isn't data to support, to confidently be able to say that in this highly divisive debate over this corporate head tax. Yeah. And so lots of questions remain about how this corporate head tax will hit Chicago businesses, you know, which we didn't attempt to try to predict the future on that one. But of course, looking for how opponents to the head tax is alternative proposal might change this week, mm-hmm. and movement from either side as the city council attempts to meet four different times each day this week, Monday through Thursday, to see if they can get a vote.
And you're heading right to City Hall after this, aren't you?
Yep.
You know, Professor, we were talking so much about the fear of job loss here, right? What leads to job growth?
Yeah, well, there you go. Real good shift of
I'm just
focus.
Trying to end this on a positive note.
No. And I'd actually like to put on a table in terms of asking questions or places to look, mm-hmm. is we could be looking at the number of new establishments created in Chicago over the time of the tax and then afterwards. And I have done a little bit of looking at that. And I think what you'll see is that when the tax was in place, you saw steady growth with the exception of recessionary periods. You saw a growth of new establishments. Mm-hmm. And by some analysis, since 2014 up to 2025, you know, give and take new licenses and renewals, there hasn't been an explosion of new startups. So there is no head tax in place. But to answer your question on a positive note, certainly investing in educating and training workforce, having a good infrastructure so that you can move product and you can move people is very relevant. Looking at regulatory conditions, regulatory issues and where they could be burdensome,
yes.
Is another way, you know, to have some impact. So, but one doesn't preclude doing the other. And certainly, if you can couple smart policy stimulus with revenue, mm-hmm. that can be a job creator.
WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
Okay, now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down, Claire Lane, WBEZ Morning Edition anchor, Michael Puente, WBEZ reporter and weekend anchor, and Mary Norkel, Chicago Sun-Times reporter. Well, you guessed it, it's December, and it was cold in Chicago. So we started by talking about the weather. Here's Mike.
You know, I don't know if they're calling it a polar vortex or whatever, but the code has, I mean, I know a lot of people are going to say, you know, it's December, it's Chicago, but this is really cold.
It was really cold. Yeah, yeah, it was really cold when I got back last night. And I hear you've been kind of suffering over the last several days. Mary, it's not even actually winter yet, which is, I think, the most striking piece of this, right? We still have until the 21st of December for it to officially have the season to officially have kicked off. But the city, it sounds like, wasn't as prepared as it usually is to handle what's been happening.
Yeah, well, part of that is because we got just hammered with snow. We got absolutely pummeled at the end of November, which we haven't seen in almost 50 years. It was record snowfall. We had both a single day record and then also to start off the season, just absolutely drowning under snow. So that obviously is a factor of it, but we did find that there was also a record number of 311 complaints about, you know, uncleared roads, uncleared sidewalks, dibs, obviously.
So, I'm looking at Claire. Claire's a culprit.
I'm pleading the fifth.
So yeah, unshoveled sidewalks, snow. Dibs, bike paths too, right?
Yes,
not
bike
being
paths,
cleared.
Yep. Complaints all around. Really, that snow comes with its consequences. You know, you got to keep the city running.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the weather in Chicago. It comes with complaints.
I mean, that's
right?
What I think.
Period.
It's hot, it's cold, everybody's complaining.
Yeah, I learned that in year one of living here. It's like, you know, as much as I thought, oh, they'd be used to this by now. No, they're still going to complain. Chicagoans are still going to complain every time this type of weather rolls around.
You know, I do got to give a shout out, though, to the Department of Transportation, either Chicago or the state of Illinois, for keeping the highways pretty much clear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've driven into the station during my anchor shift, really, you know, slick conditions and everything, but they've kept it relatively safe.
Even so pretty early in the morning when you would start.
Yeah, that's probably the most dangerous time, actually, but they've been pretty good.
Yeah.
I gotta say.
You know, I know that Mary, you and WBEZ's Alden Lowry did some digging here and found all of this out, but the thing is, again, we're famous for winters here in Chicago, and the fact that we're able to just kind of move with it and keep going, right? Schools don't get canceled. Work is still on. Why was the city so taken by surprise this time?
Well, I think we have been used to, you know, just residents and the city themselves have been used to not having this kind of snow, at least this early in the season.
Yeah, well, at least for the past few years.
Yeah, yeah. Since 2019, we were not getting this type of snow, which was the data that we had available immediately. And, you know, I was speaking with the commissioner of the Streets and Sanitation Department, Cole Stollard, and he kept mentioning that this is like February-type snow. Mm. So, you know, people would anticipate it a little bit further into the new year, but maybe not so much.
Early December.
Yeah, and even November.
Yeah. So are we getting a break from this deep freeze anytime soon, Claire?
I know. Yes, today as the start of the emergence out of the deep freeze.
Happy Monday, indeed.
And we could be well into the 40s by Thursday. So we're going to be primarily dry as well. High tomorrow, right around 38. And then if we get any precipitation, it's going to be rain, which could be a preference for some of those folks in Chicago not so winter inclined.
Mm. Well, Mary, it was a somber first night of Hanukkah last night. Chicago's Jewish community gathered in Lakeview, and you were there, right?
Yes, yes.
What did you hear from them?
So, you know, it was the first night of Hanukkah, but it also was happening in the wake of the deadly mass shooting in Australia, where another Hanukkah celebration was targeted, mm-hmm. and 15 people have died, if that's still the updated number.
At least, yeah.
Yeah, at least. And so, you know, people were there, neighbors were happy to be there and celebrating, but there was definitely an undertone of, you know, just concern and worry and anger. But the overall message was that it's important to keep celebrating and important to, you know, kind of spread this message of light, which obviously is central to the Hanukkah celebration as a whole. And, you know, people showed up in the freezing cold and on a really sad day and just kind of vowed to keep doing that.
Right. Yeah. We're checking current numbers and the death toll is still at 15 in that tragic, tragic massacre. Any reaction from Illinois leadership so far?
Yeah, so all, I believe it's 25 Jewish members of the House, U.S. House of Representatives, released a joint statement essentially condemning the violence and, you know, vowing to continue to condemn anti-Semitism. J.B. Pritzker also posted on X. I mean, everybody's just kind of expressing their support for the Jewish community at this time.
So, Claire, residents in that South Shore apartment complex will remember several months ago, which was raided by ICE. They were ordered by a judge to be out of the building by Friday, right before the deep freeze that we just talked about. I mean, any update on these former tenants?
Yeah, so our WBEZ's Esther Yunji Kang was there speaking with residents. As we know, this building was very troubled. It had, you know, a lot of systemic issues, rodent infestations, issues with electricity, heat, and a judge essentially called it a fire trap. So some residents just sort of turned in their keys, arranged another place to live, and walked off. Some even told Esther that they felt relieved.
Yes.
Others were physically forced out of the building by armed security, telling them that they literally had 30 minutes to leave their homes.
Wow.
Housing organizers, representatives from the city of Chicago were on hand to connect people with resources, but we know this can be a problem in the Chicago area. A resident even told Esther that she didn't know where she was going to sleep.
Right.
She didn't know where she was going to eat, where she was going to go. So this is something we're going to have to continue to follow and see where some of these residents do end up living.
Yeah, there's good video of some of these conversations that Esther had on WBEZ's social media pages. So check those out if you've got time, folks. But Mike, I see you shaking your head there. I mean, what comes to mind? We've talked about this raid, but now to see folks,
you know, I think what comes to mind, though, and I'm not trying to condone the raid that would happen because they were wrongfully targeted, but the raid did shine a light on this apartment complex where they could have shut down anyway and nobody would have heard about them.
Right.
Now at least they're getting a little attention from the city and the state.
Yeah. Claire, Illinois is now the first Midwest state to pass right-to-die legislation. Fill us in on that.
So patients in Illinois who are terminally ill will be able legally to request life-ending meds with a doctor's prescription, we should note, starting later next year. This is now in September. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the Medical Aid in Dying Act into law on Friday. Mm-hmm. So there are some stipulations with this. Patients must have a prognosis of 6 months or fewer to live, be mentally capable of consenting, and request the drug multiple times. So it's not just you make a phone call, you know, you say you're interested. It's a thorough process.
Yeah. We talked about this on In the Loop a couple of weeks ago, and we heard from both sides of the debate. Quite a tense conversation. Here is Kadeen Bennett. She's from the ACLU, and she's speaking in support of this legislation.
We don't call it assisted suicide because suicide is if you are going to live and you're choosing not to. I don't think we would say that somebody who chooses not to get chemotherapy is committing suicide. We won't say that somebody who is deciding that as part of their hospice care or palliative care, they've decided to get off any kind of machines. We don't call that suicide. These are people who are making a choice because they're terminal and they're making the choice of how they want to end their lives.
And here's Amber Smock from Access Living. Amber had concerns and says, hey, FYI, the original folks who pushed for bodily autonomy, those were eugenicists. Here she is.
Eugenicists were the ones that said, you know, it actually would be okay if those who are not fit to live of those who are a burden to society could actually be convinced to off themselves. And so I think that people who use the choice argument for what we call assisted suicide, proponents call it medical aid in dying, I think that people need to understand that when you're using the choice argument, that it's very much a eugenic argument and that you are buying into that. And that's not okay for people with disabilities because we've always been targets.
So now we've got a legislation in place.
Yeah, this has been several years in the making. Pritzker did issue a statement saying that the legislation will help patients, quote, avoid unnecessary pain and suffering at the end of their lives. This, again, goes into effect in September in the law.
In other news, Michael, late last week, the Trump administration was dealt an electoral blow when its redistricting plans in Indiana didn't work out as planned. Catch us up on that one.
Yeah, the Indiana State Senate, despite enormous pressure from President Trump and other MAGA followers who were threatening lawmakers, doing these what they call swatting against lawmakers, where cops show up to their home, they voted against redistricting. And I had kind of predicted that. I didn't think they would actually do it.
No surprises to you.
It was a little of a surprise because I thought if push came to shove, they were in this hearing. They were going to make it public. They wanted to find out who exactly was going to vote against it. So I was surprised that they held to their, decide that there just wasn't going to be that support.
Why were they so against redistricting?
One, they didn't like being bullied. They didn't like being harassed about it. Mm-hmm. The Indiana Senate, they're kind of an independent body there, and they take it seriously. And they also, there was no justification to do this. They just redid the redistricting 2 or 3 years ago, and they felt they were fair boundaries. And that was one of the main things why they pushed against it. And, if you don't push back on quote unquote bullying, where does it stop?
Yeah.
If you allow this to go on like this, it's just going to keep happening.
Yeah. Any response or reaction from Illinois?
Well, Illinois says, it was going to be dependent whether Illinois moves forward with their own redistricting plans on what Indiana does. So that remains to be seen. Can I just add one other thing about this? So President Trump has been threatening to withhold federal transportation dollars against the state of Indiana. You know, if he does that, what would be the rationale to do that? Would it be legal? It could put Indiana Attorney General, Republican Attorney General Todd Rokita, who's a huge Trump supporter, would it push him to actually have to sue the Trump administration to get some of the money back since there would be no legal justification to withhold any kind of federal funding?
Interesting. Claire, the federal government, speaking of them, they're conducting an audit of the Chicago Housing Authority. What's going on there?
Yes, this is happening across various states across the country. Illinois, just one of a handful of these. Looking into the Chicago Housing Authority records obtained by the Sun-Times show that HUD's inspector general sort of just scrutinizing how the city is verifying residents' immigration statuses and their criminal backgrounds. CHA, again, being investigated, also District of Columbia's Housing Authority. And people are saying, the CHA's audit is just another attempt by President Trump's administration to target criminal activity in Chicago and other Democratic-led cities. So we are seeing this trend, part of this agenda.
We've seen this before. Anything else you're watching?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very tragic weekend across the country. We had a shooting at Brown University.
Mary mentioned
the shooting in Australia. And there was a tragic death in Los Angeles. Many prominent people, including Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, mourning the loss of Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle Singer Reiner. They were killed in the Los Angeles home on Sunday. LAPD investigating the deaths as homicide. Barack Obama saying that Reiner had a deep belief in the goodness of people. Governor Pritzker saying he's devastated and that his legacy is, essentially going to be secured in the works of his art that have impacted generations of people. When Harry Met Sally, Spinal
All
Tap.
All in the Family.
Yes, his original.
He was just here with WBEZ a few months ago for an event.
He was, and many people attend. That was a sold-out event for us.
Right.
So clearly beloved.
Gosh, so tragic.
In Chicago and all over the country. So something we'll be following, more reaction to come.
Yeah. Mary, a very specific Guinness World Record that was just made by an Illinois native. I mean, Did you see this story?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. A colleague of mine, Casey, he reported that the Reverend Vicky Garlock broke the Guinness World Record for visiting the most places of worship, and she did so in the Chicago area, 185 places all within the month of September. So wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and something like, you know, 14 in one day.
Yes, 14 in one day across Evanston and Wilmette.
Which makes me wonder, I mean, how long are these visits? Are you popping in and out? Or, you know, how do you get to 14 different places of worship in 14
in one
day?
You have to be strict on your time is what I'm thinking. And, you know, you've got travel time and, God forbid, traffic. And, you know, it's a logistical feat as well as just an interesting record. So
I'm just asking the hard-hitting questions
here,
Mary.
Yeah, I mean, we're in need of some light news. So good for her. You know, we're happy for her.
Shout out to Reverend Vicky Garlock. Mm-hmm. Michael, Salvation Army's Red Kettles, they're having a blue Christmas.
Yeah, you know, donations are down. They're not really exactly sure why. They speculate it could have everything to do with the economy, layoffs, inflation, all just impacting their Red Kettle, not just here in Chicago, but also Northwest Indiana. But they do have an out. So when you're going past a, you know, grocery store and you see the Red Kettles, I don't have any change. They got a QR code now. Mm. So I'm not trying to guilt anybody, but click
they
on
got
that
Apple
QR
Pay
code.
Too?
They probably do. Yeah. And so just, you know, a couple of bucks here and there. It goes through a lot of services. They do so much good work in Chicago and Northwest Indiana. So you don't have that change. I never carry change now. It just don't have it. I'm always using the debit card. They have that QR code.
Yeah.
Or you can go to their website.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.